So what happens is events that basically sell like a significant portion of their events the day they go live or the week they go live, they do well. And yeah, it's because these are events people want to go to for sure. But it's also because you immediately have this group of people that will advocate for your events in the lead up. So let's say I sell 200 tickets today, then those 200 people in the 3 months that I have before my event starts are going to convince their friends to come, because we all are very social creatures. We want to be with the people we'd like, and we want to kind of convince and use our influence to get the right people where we are. So getting those first people on board is really like its own marketing channel.
Hey, welcome back to Women Disrupting Tech, and thank you for tuning in to episode 167. My name is Dirk-Jan Hupkes, and this is the podcast that closes the funding gap in venture capital by amplifying the stories of female founders and their investors. Now, how do you decide if you want to go to an event? If you're like me, and 97% of people, you go where your friends are going, or to a place where you think that it's likely you'll meet like-minded people. After all, as humans, we're social creatures, we want to belong. Now imagine you're an event organizer. To attract the right crowd, you need to attract the 3% of discoverers, because those are the people who determine where the other 97% of people are going. So the question becomes, how do you reach those discoverers? And how do you turn them into ambassadors for your event? To answer that question, I am joined by Elise Mol. Elise Mol is the co-founder of Bash, a startup that helps event organizers sell out their event by helping them create and activate a community of visitors. As you'll hear, many of the lessons from this episode apply to event organizers, but also to founders. You'll learn why you should sell to early fans who understand the concept of what you're building, and why you want to enable them to be your ambassador to their friends, what Elise and her co-founders get out of partnering with investors who have built companies themselves, and how scheduling thinking time, including writing down the topic you'll be thinking about, can help your company grow. In the end, the main takeaway from this episode is about the power of community, both in organizing a successful event and in building a company. One thing to note, in the time between recording our conversation and you listening, Elise has decided to leave Bash to pursue other opportunities. She continues, however, to support the other founders in making Bash a success. With that, when you're ready to discover how you can turn early fans into the marketing engine, here's my conversation with Elise Mol. Before we start, I wanted to let you know about a cool event that is coming up. The TEDx Kolhaven Women event takes place on October 9th from 6:30 to 11:30 in the evening at Halvier aan de Maas in Rotterdam. This year's theme is The New Builders, a theme that seamlessly aligns with the content on this podcast. Throughout the evening, you'll hear powerful TED Talks from women who are redesigning the systems that shape our lives, from leadership and parenting to women's health, mental health care, and access to investment capital. Together, they'll explore what it takes to build a better future. As a listener to this podcast, you know that we're living in a time of transformation, one that women can and should contribute to as well. So you know that this evening is going to be one of a kind. That is why I'm happy to offer you the opportunity to be there in person, to listen to groundbreaking talks, and meet and network with like-minded people. As a listener to this podcast, you'll get a 25% discount when you use the code WDT25 at checkout. And even though this is a TEDx Women event, men are very welcome to join. To buy your ticket, follow the link in the caption and remember to use the code WDT25 before entering your payment details. With that, let's listen to this week's episode of Women Disrupting Tech. So, Elise Mol, welcome to Women Disrupting Tech. Good to have you. Let's start with some background. How did you get started with Bash?
We started with Bash in a very curious time. I think it was 2020. So there was two things happening. We had COVID hit.
Yeah.
And we had the decline of Facebook. And we were in that phase where you really want to know what your friends are up to, but we're also really anti-big tech. So we kind of saw that everyone was leaving Facebook, but this really critical, nice part was being left behind, which was called Facebook Events. And we decided that we would build it. And it was the height of COVID, but we figured that would be done soon. And then that would be like the summer of events, the summer of social. Everyone would want to go out. So that's basically how we started. I think for all of us, it was kind of like this in-between time. And we just together and decided to build something.
Okay. So how long did it take for COVID to actually finish? When did you start building it? Like really at the start, beginning of COVID or?
No, so, the first wave, and then we didn't call it the first wave then. We thought that would be the wave. So it took another year and a half before COVID was actually done.
Do you consider that an upside or looking after at it right now? But was it better or was it actually holding you back at the time?
Well, I think at the time, it was not a very positive thing for us because I think our whole growth was dependent on people getting together, which is something that wasn't allowed. So we would see these really fast growing peaks of like the start of exponential growth. And then you would see a lockdown and all of our numbers would go to zero. So we kind of went through that a couple of times. But I do think you learn very quickly because as a team, you need to quickly reevaluate. Like, what do we actually want to build? You know, people come up with all sorts of ideas, like maybe you should do online events. And we quickly decided that wasn't for us. So I do think it brought some positive stuff.
Yeah. Why wasn't online events for you?
We really enjoy bringing people together in real life. So I do think the whole team kind of flows on that belief and that we really enjoy helping event organizers because they do stuff like that. So for us, the pivot to like more of a Discord setting wasn't it.
Okay. So you started out as because you wanted to build a sort of, let's say, Facebook events of Facebook.
Yeah.
When did you realize it was a bigger opportunity to help people organize the events instead of just driving or showing people where the events were?
I think it happened quite naturally. We started off building like a private proposition. So it's kind of like you create your own event page, you invite some friends, you share a little link, and they tell you they're coming. And then we kind of like built that out into this discovery platform where you could see what your friends are up to. And by trying to complete that discovery platform, we wanted to bring the organizers on board as well. So we wanted to have this, like, basically the complete set of events happening in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands and all the people looking for them on one place. And then we started kind of getting that off the ground and we realized that for organizers, this was actually such a huge opportunity because we were thinking from a user perspective. So we were thinking, I want to know what my friends are up to. But organizers want that as well. They want people to come along. So they want to have that kind of like word of mouth marketing for their event. And so once we realized that, we decided that it would be much nicer to start helping them and like target it from more of a business to business perspective instead of from the user side.
Yeah. And the way you help them is to actually drive early stage sales for events. Yeah.
Yeah, so event organizers use us and we provide them with the tool, this kind of like a community ticket shop. So anything and everything to do with activating your community to buy early, bring friends. And we do this through an access layer and like a branded space for your community where you can do things like a pre-sale, ambassador tools. You can have like memberships with different tickets, stuff like that.
Okay, so maybe for the... let's say the Gen Z or Gen X people among us, the boomers. How is that different from early bird ticket sales?
Early bird ticket sales are a way to reward people who buy early, but they're not necessarily a way to reward your community because they're still public tickets, right? Like everyone can see them. And what we help you do is always kind of approach this in an exclusive way. So what you want as an organizer is you want this growing group of people who return to your event and are super excited. And of course, you do that mainly through organizing an amazing event. But you also do that by seeing them, rewarding them, and knowing who they are. And that's the part we help you with. And it doesn't work if that's public tickets or discount codes. It needs to have that kind of like almost security, because otherwise it's not exclusive.
Okay, so but then security not in the traditional sense like IT security, but...
No. I mean like that the tickets are only available for people, for example, who've been before. So that you actually guard that. You make sure that the things you want to give to your community are things exclusively for them.
Yeah, okay. So it's actually to also a bit to create the community and maintain it also during, let's say, in the time between events.
Yeah, I do think most of the communities organizers create themselves, and we help you grow it, and we help you formalize it, and we help you leverage it. But I do think event organizers are really good at creating their own communities, because that's kind of what events are built on in the first place.
Okay, so let's zoom out for a bit, because we did a prep call and then you told me something I didn't know, because I thought like this event space had, when COVID ended and we all could go back to our quote-unquote normal lives again, this exploded. But you said, well, actually, this is an industry that is, let's say, under pressure, that is having a lot of difficulty. What has changed? Maybe during COVID or maybe after it, that made it so difficult for event organizers?
Yeah, it's definitely an industry under pressure. And I do think you see it in the news where you see these kind of like middle-sized festivals really struggling to sell out. Like even really big organizers that used to sell out instantly, like Lowlands took a while this year. Like that kind of stuff, that is really new. And that is because a couple of things have changed. And I think the main one is there's a lot of organizers. So there's a lot of like new stuff, people are growing. And paired with that is that the demand is kind of lowering. Costs are rising for organizers, so their ticket prices are increasing. And people can only spend their money once. They can't attend 10 festivals in a year. Compare that also with that the spending power of like the generation below us is becoming a bit less. This like problem is exacerbated. So you have this kind of like perfect storm of lots of event organizers with really expensive tickets and basically a target audience that doesn't have that much to spend.
Yeah. So when you're facing declining ticket sales, how do they currently deal with that, the event organizers, if they don't know about your platform? What do they do?
I think there's different things they do. Like some of course try to scale back. Some try to do different things in their operations, so they maybe book different artists. They spend a lot on marketing because they only see this kind of problem a bit last minute. So I think everyone deals with it in a different way.
Okay. So I think we also talked about the fact that Meta ads and Google ads are becoming much more expensive and as a result also less effective.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's also more of that. How does that play into the picture?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is that Instagram back in the day used to be, for example, this channel where as an organizer, you would just kind of communicate with your fan base very one-on-one. And that is becoming more and more monetized. So where you would just kind of reach people naturally by posting something. That is now being more like you only get real views if you pay. So kind of that like own channel is becoming more expensive. And also your ads are getting more expensive because you're just competing with everyone for the same attention.
Yeah. Yeah, it's also that indeed what they call real estate in the feed is less and in the stories is less, but indeed also the space, the tickets or the ticket sizes for the ads are becoming more expensive. You just pay more for the same number of views and for the name, thereby also more for the same conversion that you need.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens if an event doesn't have these early sales that we talked about before? What is the consequence of that downstream? Because you just mentioned something important. They start doing ads when they see that ticket sales are not there where they want. So then they put a lot of ads out, but that's often too late, yeah?
Yeah, I think there are so many different ways to approach it, but I do think that across the board, we see this. So what happens is events that basically sell like a significant portion of their events the day they go live or the week they go live, they do well. And it's of course, it's because these are events people want to go to for sure. But it's also because you immediately have this group of people that will advocate for your events in the lead up. So let's say I sell 200 tickets today, then those 200 people in the 3 months that I have before my event starts are going to convince their friends to come because we all are very social creatures. We want to be with the people we'd like, and we want to kind of convince and use our influence to get the right people where we are. So getting those first people on board is really like its own marketing channel.
Yeah. How did you find this out that it were that you actually need to do a lot of early ticket sales?
Yeah, I think I really like that about my job. Is I got to talk to so many event organizers. So I think we are in a very special position where I have firsthand conversations with so many organizers, and they all have like they all do this for their livelihood. So they know what they're talking about. So they all have this very personal and branded insight into how their community works. Mm-hmm. And I get to generalize that and I get to look at the data. So I get to see like what kind of translate from one brand to the other brand. And basically I got to test this hypothesis that many organizers have that they're like, if I sell out 60% of my tickets by this, then I'll do well. And I got to like verify it. So that's something you see a lot.
Okay. Is there a sort of sweet spot for, let's say, ticket sales? Like you have to have sold like 60% of your tickets at this point before the event starts? Or
It's usually like one of the rules you have is that by the week of the event, usually your ticket sales still double. So you have to sell quite a significant part in the beginning. Like, let's say, 20% you're doing really well. If you sell it like the day of or maybe the first week. But also this does differ per brand. And like, let's say you have a reoccurring event that happens every week. This is different. But let's say you're a big event organizer, then usually 20% by the first week is good. We even push people to do like the pre-sale. So when no public tickets are live yet, that's where you want to have sold already like quite a bit. And then you see that by the last week or by the last day, you'll still double that amount because then you'll have those last minute people texting people like, hey, what are you doing? Or the weather is nice. What will I be up to today? But you do need that amount to double.
Why? Because there's a cost involved as well, I think. You spend cost like before the event. So I suppose early ticket sales means also that you get a certain base of your cost back, which makes it easier to, let's say, at least maybe also book bigger guests shortly before the and have a good
Yeah. It depends on how big you are as an organizer, but this can also be like quite an important factor that you want kind of part of your investment back before you spend everything. And I think it's also a large part of security. So what you really don't want as an organizer is to find out that the weather has changed the day before and no one is coming. So you do want that kind of like buy-in, that excitement, so that people just come to your event.
Does the security also apply to people attending the event in the sense like, hey, I know that maybe my friends are going there, but also that it's already near to sold out?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. People like to be at places that other people want to go to. So you want to go to an event that is doing well. So this is also like part marketing, part real, but it's not a coincidence that organizers will always tell you we're almost sold out. Like, it's going super well. The early birds are flying. Like, this is social behavior.
Yeah. Is it also important for event organizers to start communicating early that ticket sales are going well?
Yeah. So they do. I think in most cases it's true. I don't see organizers lying, but it is like before the event, you usually try to build up hype, like what is coming up. And then once you start with your ticket sales, it's much more about like creating that FOMO, like we're selling out quickly. People are already buying. This ticket is expired. Like, kind of like trying to introduce that urgency so that people commit.
Yeah. And that urgency then also sort of adds to FOMO.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you're trying to make people not decide at the last minute, because the earlier they buy, the more people they'll bring. And like this whole exclusive, time-bound, plus one, this system, this is what we optimize for organizers.
Okay, clear. Just going back a bit, so at some point you understand that early ticket sales are key to an event's success. How did you then think about the role that Bash has in that process? How did you fit Bash into that?
That's a good question. I think it really comes from our the whole history of Bash. So I think our core proposition has never changed. And this is the belief that people go to events because other people are going. So that we are social creatures. Actually, there's a fun stat. 97% of people go to an event because someone else is going.
Not because they have the intrinsic belief that...
No, 3% are discoverers. And discoverers are people who, for example, follow a DJ and will be the one that kind of convinces their friend group. But everyone else just kind of looks online or to their friends and likes to be at a place they feel they belong. I think that is what powered our first products, this kind of discovery platform, these social event pages. And I think that is also what drives us in helping organizers, because we come from this perspective. And I do think that it has to be quite strong, because if you start a business in this scene, organizers will always want your help at the very last minute. So when they haven't sold out, that's when they come to you. And I think it's quite easy to build kind of like a discount product on top of that. But that's really not the direction we want to take, because we think it's always a symptom of not having taken that community serious in the beginning, not knowing who they are, not targeting them correctly, not building enough momentum. So basically, we always advise organizers like, okay, for this one, we can't help you, but come back for the next one and we'll try to really, really like build a more sustainable solution to this.
Okay, do they actually come back?
Yeah, I think most do, because I think most do realize, like, especially in combination with like ads getting more expensive and everything, that they don't want to be dependent on having to sell their whole events just by ads. So you want that community that kind of like buys the first 20%, maybe 50% of your tickets, and that comes back every time, because it's just much more fun. You have an event with people who understand what you're doing. And it's much cheaper, because you don't have to re-spend marketing every event. You just have to retarget your people.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the old adage that existing customers are a better source of income than
it's very much new. That retention story. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you convince event organizers who are still doing this by through ads, who are still thinking, okay, we only need that the help for the last mile, not for the beginning?
Yeah.
So how do you change that belief?
Well, I think I've tried changing people's mind about stuff, and that usually doesn't work. So I do think people have to come to this realization by themselves. And what we do, what I really like, is we help organizers who want this already. So people partner with us because they understand this and they like the kind of idea we have about this, so we can build something together. And then you see that, for example, now we did the whole ADE pre-sale with Audio Obscura. And you'll see other organizers coming in saying, okay, this was actually very cool and I want something similar. So I do see it that you have to prove it with the organizers that get it, and then the other ones will follow.
So it's actually building something and making it, showing that it works.
Yeah.
Like you did with ADE, which I think was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very cool. But it's like if you have to convince someone of this, it will be really hard because you have to change their behavior. So we're looking for the organizer that already wants to do this, but there's no real technical support for this. And then we help them with that.
Okay. So, and that's also the gap that you're in, because there is no technical support for this. You're the go-to party.
Exactly. We're the community ticket shop.
Okay, cool. Are there any other things besides starting early with the ticket sales and fostering their community, or using their community to actually sell the tickets? Is there other things that organizers of successful events do differently today?
Well, I, of course, very much see the technical bits and like the part we help with. But I do think the most valuable thing you can do as an organizer is just create an amazing event, right? Like, that is 90% of the work. It's with them, and they, I don't know what events you attend yourself, but you'll see it, like, if you've been to an event that has like a high production value and like the details are right and the music is amazing and the people are good, that will drive you to come back, and we're just helping you channel that.
Okay. And so it's actually that the art of organizing event hasn't really changed. You still have to do the basics.
Yeah, of course. Yes, it's really about that real life experience, that kind of like moments in time where you make people have this amazing social experience, and you let them kind of step outside of their daily life, do something fun with friends. That's really what it's all about. And it's just the marketing part that has changed.
Yeah, okay, clear. And part of that marketing is about belonging. So I want to go to the events that my friends go to.
Yeah.
I'm part of the 97%, I admit.
Yeah.
How did you build that into the, let's say, into Bash on the, let's say, visitor end?
That kind of social thing.
You mean?
Yeah. I do think like the place we start is that community. So it's social in a broader sense. So it's people who, for example, have attended your event before, or for example, people who pre-register for your pre-sale, like they know about you, they're intrinsically motivated to go to your events. And we create this super exclusive time-bound community experience for them. So that's, I think, a lot about branding. That's a lot about, just making that work technically, and like having that access layer unlock certain stuff for certain people. And then the forwarding stuff, so the plus ones, that is part of most of our kind of solutions. So for example, if you have a pre-sale, you have sign-up sheet for that pre-sale, and then you get your tickets. But as an organizer, you can decide this person only gets their own, or it gets one ticket for themselves and maybe three for other people. And we encourage that kind of like plus one system, so that people forward those link on their own preferred social media, which is usually like WhatsApp.
Yeah, and then people can book from that link and get the same benefit,
yeah,
I presume.
Yeah, exactly. So you have this kind of like, you and a friend can come again.
Ah, okay. And this is also how you grow the community, because that leads to people signing up and leaving their emails. And so they get part of the group that is offered the same tickets next time.
Exactly. Kind of build this community around those people. And you have this like oil.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Spill.
Yeah. You kind of grow through the plus ones.
Yeah. And just for clarity's sake, you're not a ticketing platform itself. You've sort of, you're sort of a layer on top of that. Yeah. Why was it important to build it that way and not build a ticketing platform?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons for that. I think the first one is focus. It's like there's many ticketing providers out there. So we want to help event organizers. They don't really need a new ticketing provider. They need a way to reach their audience, a way to activate their community, a way to sell early. So you only have limited time, you only have limited developing capacity. So we decided to focus all of our energy on getting that right. And then the other one is also very practical. Organizers have this long-standing relationship with their ticketing provider. It's it's usually contracts of years, but it's also like a trust relationship they have with them. It's not something they're looking to change up. And so it's much nicer for us from a focus perspective, but also from a practical scaling perspective, to just integrate with these ticket organizations and to help all the organizers that are on their platforms. And that way, we can also be ticketing provider agnostic. So whether you choose WeStix or Paylogic or Stager, you can still work with us because they all struggle with this community sales part.
Okay, and how did ticket providers respond to what you offer?
I think most are really excited. So for example, we have a really good relationship with WeStix. And what they really like is there's, of course, all these kind of extra things organizers can do and want. And by making their system communicate really well with our system, their organizers sell more tickets and have a better experience. So it's a win-win.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a win for the festival organizers. It's a win for those platforms. And then it also feeds into your business because you get more or better word of mouth.
Yeah.
So you and go also, from all kinds of market.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. So I want to talk a bit about how you build company. Let's say not the product part, but more the company building part, because we also talked about fundraising. And so far, I think you've raised about 2 million. And what struck me in our conversation before is that you deliberately chose investors who had built startups themselves. Why is that that experience important for you? Why did you choose to go that way and not for just, let's say, money?
Yeah, I think it goes two ways, because I think these are people we really understand and we know how to talk to. They have a similar mindset. They think about growth in the same way. And so people who've already done something like this, they think in a similar way. So I think our pitch lands much better. It's also people we really respect and we really like to have on board. And it's people who have, I don't want to speak for them, but everyone who's built a startup has made many mistakes. And you kind of want to share that knowledge. It's a nice way of kind of like reliving that and making the next generation avoid those mistakes.
Sort of paid forward in that
sense. Yeah, I think so. Yeah. So I do think that especially now there's this really big understanding that as the Netherlands, but also as Europe, we need a much stronger startup scene. We need to be much more ambitious and we need more money and we need to grow faster. And so I think every successful entrepreneur I've spoken to is somehow reinvesting into that ecosystem, either with knowledge or time or money. So I do think that is really, that's a really nice way to grow and to help each other.
Okay. So what's one piece of advice you got that you were like, oh, that is very good to know?
Oh, I think so many. I think it's in everything, right? It's like in like how you do your technical setup, or just like the little tegeltjes we have in the Netherlands, like focus. And then you can read a book, but it's not the same as when someone like tells you in an advisory board meeting, you're like, you're trying to do too much, right? Like it's people who have been in your shoes and understand the choices you're making and also which ones didn't turn out well for them.
Okay. So, and especially that last part is, I suppose, important. But what is one decision that you remember, like, okay, we were going to do A, but as a result of the advisory board meeting or the board meeting, we went another way?
Yeah, I think one is scaling throughout the Netherlands and scaling abroad. I think we always started with this idea of like the world, like we'll target everywhere. We're super technical, so it doesn't need to be within borders. And then you speak to other entrepreneurs who've done this and they say, no, cultural differences matter hugely, and try and get it right somewhere first and then scale from that like super solid base.
Yeah. How is that in events? Because this is something we talked about before, yeah? And that I remembered, like, okay, an event is basically technically the same everywhere.
Yeah.
It's people coming together with good artists. So what are cultural differences, let's say, from here to the UK or from here to Belgium or to Germany?
Well, I think one of the differences, for example, is how early do you buy tickets? Like, do you buy at the door or do you buy months in advance? Do you buy for yourself? Do you buy for the music? Do you buy for the crowd? What kind of marketing do you respond to well? Like, is it more pushy? Or, for example, in the Netherlands, we're really done with like the discount stuff. So like discount codes in my email and like newsletters I don't want to read. Like I perceive this as very annoying. But other countries might have a really different idea on stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's the part about discount codes in my mailbox I recognize.
Yeah.
But I wasn't actually aware. But do English people then buy later in general?
No, I think they buy earlier actually, because but to be fair, we're not we have like one or two clients that also organize this in the UK, but we have no like UK organizers, so I haven't found this out. But I do know that because going out is even more expensive over there, so people decide earlier.
Ah, to make sure okay. So then there, the platform could have a good fit.
Yeah, I do think that would be a really nice next market, for example.
Yeah. Could there be, what are plans for the future? Do you keep pushing deep on the Netherlands, or do you at some point want to go wide internationally?
No, I think but we do have very much international ambition. But I do think there is many organizers to help here. Like we have a really worldwide known event scene. We're like one of the best in the world festival wise. We have so much nightlife. We're so diverse in like the kind of events we offer. So I do think there's a lot to do here. But I think as soon as we feel that we have this kind of like rolling machine, and scale it up.
Yeah. So actually what you do is also create a sort of sense of belonging.
Yeah.
And that to me is sort of a human need. I was wondering how Bash could scale, let's say, beyond just a festival and the events scene, because belonging is important regardless of where it could be apply in the workplace, could apply, yeah. To the you see that now with the World Cup, that people want to belong to a team.
Yeah,
that you actually see for context of listeners, we're recording this during the World Cup. The Netherlands has just left the tournament, but they had these orange walks where that would get publicity just about anywhere in the world, like 20,000 people jumping left and right, literally. And I heard a lot of stories about Americans actually buying orange stuff and walking in that group just to be there.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
So I figured, let's say that sense of belonging, that sense of identity sort of scales across the event scene. How do you look at that?
Yeah, I think it across the event scene for sure. So I think events-wise, we're focusing on very much like clubs and festivals and promoters at the moment. But I can see a world in which we're targeting more broadly than that. But I also do know that the products I use and love are quite specific. Like it's not about having this Swiss knife of like a million options and I build my own, but it's about having this very opinionated, very structured, very clean design system in which I get to do what I want because it's built for me. And so I do think keeping that for now and really focusing on those event organizers, understanding exactly their need and building something that works really well for them, I think that's the way we're going to make this work.
Yeah, but there's also personalization layer sort of that I hear in there because it also targets, let's say, build something that is relevant for me as an event attendee.
Yeah, 100%. So it is this kind of like more complete social network where you have event attendees and the organizers that organize the events that they attend. And that can become more of a network at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. How far out is that, you think?
I think I've tried to really focus on not getting too many steps ahead. So I think we've always had these like really grand plans. But it works much better just set like a simple goal, work toward it really well, and then make sure that fits into the bigger picture. So I'm not sure.
Okay. Double click on that for me. So the smaller goals. Because most startups work from these grand visions.
Yeah.
We're going to conquer the world.
Yeah.
It's also what sells really well into investors.
Yeah.
Because they can immediately sort of see the scale.
Yeah.
How do you then, let's say, translate that back into, okay, and this is what we need to do today, this week, this month?
Yeah. Well, I do think that like the big goals are really useful for inspiring and getting people to join and investors and everything. And I think it's nice to have that like that main goal. But it's usually quite vague. So if you have to decide what you're working towards, it leaves people feeling a bit lost. So I think like most other companies, we have this structure of like, we have a quarter and then we evaluate our goals. And then we kind of set this one thing that we really want to achieve. And by setting that, everyone knows how they're contributing to that. You also create this sense of achievement within the team because you're all working on the same thing, making that happen.
Okay. And how do you ensure that goals that you choose for the quarter or the month are in line with the grander vision? Is that because the grander vision is, well, to some extent, you have to prove over time that you're getting closer to the goal, I suppose.
Yeah.
So how do you align that?
I think for us, it's usually quite clear. So I don't think that has been very difficult in the past. But also one of the things we really like is that we set our goals and then we talk to our advisors and we talk it through. So I think that also has a very nice kind of third eye principle where someone else looks at it and kind of questions it critically to make sure that we're doing the right things.
How do you take a step back from, let's say, the day-to-day operation? How do you make time to think?
One of the things I like to do sometimes is either work at home or in another country. I don't do this very often, but it does help me kind of take that distance. But I also think it's quite simple, like blocking time. So just making sure that you, for yourself, have this kind of like blocked time in your agenda to think. And I think we do this with the founders as well, where we're kind of just like, okay, now we're thinking about this one thing, and we're sitting together in a room and doing it. Yeah, I think you need to schedule it, otherwise it slides away.
Yeah, for sure. If you're not planning it and then also sit down on that day, then it doesn't happen.
Yeah. And I think it also starts with formulating the question well. So if you know what you want to be thinking about, I notice that once I've written down what it is I kind of want to figure out, it happens continuously. So it's not even that I have to like sit and think, but it's like washing the dishes and I'm like thinking about it, or like biking somewhere and I'm thinking about it. Like if I have this one clear goal that what I want to figure out, it kind of happens always.
Interesting that you mentioned washing the dishes. That's usually when I get to my best ideas. Anyways, that's a different conversation. I want to close with two questions that I have. One is that I'm building something myself. It's called fundingcoach.ai. It's a tool to connect female founders with investors. That in part has to do with belonging, but also with trust. And I was wondering what if you would build a tool like that, what would be a design principle or a feature that you take from Bash that you would install there?
Yeah, I thought about it. I thought it was a good question. I think the thing I would take is that you take your biggest fans and use them as like the way to grow. So making sure that everyone who's had a positive experience kind of pays it forward in the product or outside. So that if someone fundraised through you, like just like a party you want your friends to be at, I think the female founder system is similar, where if you make it, if you go somewhere, you want to help other female entrepreneurs get better. So leverage that.
So include also the pay it forward mentality.
Yeah,
that's one.
Even if it's just like writing a review or sending it to someone, like a little link or sharing your story somewhere. I think that really, that would help me with trust and belonging.
Okay, great. Elise Mol, thank you very much for a great interview. Really enjoyed this trip into the event scene that in. Yeah, I don't know a lot about, but it's a good learning experience. Thanks for that. If people would like to learn more about Bash or connect with you, where would you like to send them?
They can see bash.social for more information, and they can send me a message on LinkedIn or, I think LinkedIn probably.
Yeah, or hit you up on an event that you attend. Okay, any events in the planning?
Many. But I do think next up is something at Lo-Fi.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can see me there.
Cool. Elise Mol, thank you very much for an amazing interview. Listeners, thank you very much for listening. And until the next episode, as always, keep being awesome. Well, that's it. Thank you for listening to episode 167 of Women Disrupting Tech, titled Turning Early Fans into a Marketing Engine with Elise Mol. Elise and I hope you found our conversation as informative and practical as we intended it to be. And if you have any questions for Elise about this episode, please leave them in the comment section on Spotify, YouTube, and or Apple Podcasts. If you want to connect with Elise or learn more about Bash, please check out the links in the show notes. As usual, you can find the show notes at womendisruptingtech.blog and on my Substack via the links in the caption. There you can also find the links to the TEDx Kolhaven Women event and to my new fundingcoach.ai tool. If you found this episode useful, please take a moment to rate and review the show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. And if you don't follow us yet, please hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss a future episode. Every week, you'll hear how another founder or investor is working to close the funding gap, one conversation at a time. Once again, thank you for listening. I hope to see you in the next episode. And until then, as always, keep being awesome.